Well, Dr. Naylor, you have witnessed an awful lot of development in Southern Baptist life in the 20th century. As a matter of fact, you've witnessed probably most of the developments in the 20th century in Southern Baptist life. And what I wanted to ask you to do is to give us a brief overview of your life and ministry and how it is that you have come to know so much about Southern Baptist history and the progress we've experienced in our history. And of course, you mentioned in your memoirs about your Baptist upbringing and your parents and your father's ministry, your education, pastoral and denominational service. If you could just give us a brief overview of your life and ministry, that would kind of help us and put everything into context.
Perhaps I ought to say first that my father and mother married in 1901 and went to Indian Territory in a place called Wagner. He had been an associational missionary here in Texas for a year. But this is the background. It's the background of a pioneer state.
Right.
And pastorate by pastorate, he was a missionary, faithful preacher, spent 54 years in Oklahoma.
Oh.
And I was born in Hartshorn in 1909. Which makes much of the century, all right.
Yes.
And so, as we move through the questionnaire that will be the basis of our discussion, there's much of it that Dad represents when you talk about the period through which we came, called the Depression.
Right.
His ministry reflected this in financial stress, but never was it reflected in his spirit or attitude.
Oh, yeah.
And so, God called me to preach in my senior year in college in Ada, Oklahoma. In fact, the 29th of this month will be the 70th anniversary of my first sermon.
Oh, my.
It was in that senior year that, in a very dramatic thing for me, God made his call to preach positive and sure.
Right.
And my pastor, a church of 1,000 in the congregation, said, well, he'd be away in 2 weeks. I could just preach that Sunday morning. And so it's against that background that my ministry developed. I went to Southwestern in 1928, received an PhD degree in 1932, went to Nashville, Arkansas to be to my first pastorate after the seminary.
Right.
County seat town, church of 500 members, alive, vital, absolutely. The first year, I believe the congregation gave $3,600, which reflects the financial times
right.
that you speak of.
Right.
And then from Nashville, Arkansas, it was Malvern, Arkansas, First Baptist Church, 3 years. Arkadelphia, Arkansas, First Baptist Church, College Town, Ouachita Baptist College.
Right.
And I was there 7 years. Enid, Oklahoma, First Baptist Church, 3 years. First Baptist Church, Columbia, South Carolina.
Right.
5 years. And then Travis Avenue Baptist Church here in Fort Worth. Magnificent church.
Right.
I spent 5 years. 6 years as pastor there,
uh-huh.
and then 20 years as president of the seminary.
Right.
I'd been a trustee of the seminary 17 years from these states of which I've spoken.
Right.
And it says something about my ministry and commitment that I love the seminary and have from the moment I saw it in
right.
my first year.
Oh, that's obvious.
And it's against that background that you could ask questions about
right.
my ministry.
Now, tell me something. Did you were a trustee at Southwestern? Were you a trustee at Southwestern during Dr. Scarborough's last few years as president?
His last year.
Okay.
I deeply loved Dr. Scarborough.
Yes.
And when the convention in 1941, as I relate in the little book. I was sitting out in the courtyard, temperature-wise. I was sitting out there hearing suddenly the report of the Committee on Boards, and they said Robert Naylor was to be a trustee of this, of the Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary.
Yes.
In 41.
Okay.
I'd been out of the seminary 9 years.
Okay.
And so Dr. Scarborough, I go to the first board meeting that fall, which is itself quite a story. And Ms. Naylor and I went to the meeting. And Dr. Scarborough became ill before the next convention. There was a committee seeking a president, to which, would you believe it, I was appointed as a member.
Oh, yes.
Silent member.
You meant, yeah.
Dr. Truitt was chairman of the committee. And Dr. Scarborough's illness was a long illness. He died, I think, in 45.
Right, right. So you served, your years as a trustee were primarily during Dr. Head's and Dr. Williams' administration there at the seminary then.
Right. I was on the committees that brought them to their place.
Yes, okay. Okay, that's right. Okay.
Chairman of the trustees under Dr. Williams.
Right, right. Dr. Naylor, I want to ask you your opinion about the following statement. The Baptist missionary advance following World War II was fueled primarily by a deep desire Baptists developed in the trials of the 20s and 30s, but were denied because of economic depressions and war. What is your opinion of that statement?
I think it has points at which it needs explanation.
Okay.
The depression. The book says, you know, our afflictions work for us.
Right.
I think the depression brought a certain kind of blessing to our denomination.
Okay.
In the first place, we faced biblical standards of giving,
yep,
not financial standards. We didn't have money. But the book says you tithe.
Right.
And preachers preach tithing. I preach to my churches what the book says, and I don't hear much of that anymore.
Oh, yeah.
In the midst of affluence. And our people developed a unity, a sense of a world's need. The war made great contribution at this point of stirring and moving people about in the country. And we became suddenly more aware of our world, that's true. But financially, it's just one of those battles that needs lots of attention.
Right, right. So you would, with that explanation, you would agree then that some of the trials faced in the 20s and 30s because of the depressions and the wars may have contributed then to the missionary advance following World War II.
The quality of our denomination. I think at that point I need to say that in 1920, after these pastorates, Dad became a general missionary in Oklahoma, employed by the State Mission Board and the Home Mission Board for 10 years in western Oklahoma. And one by one, as the Depression closed in and throttled our churches and the debts began to mount, these missionaries were separate, were no longer employed. Dad was the last one in Oklahoma.
I see.
And in 1930, he became an associational missionary, and the mission program of the state had just financially collapsed.
Oh, my. But those financial trials did cause preachers to preach on biblical tithing.
And to trust God.
And to trust God, okay.
And get a new sense of identity as the fellowship of the churches.
Well, Dr. Naylor, that leads into my third question, which I think essentially you really just covered. Both you and Jesse Fletcher, in your respective books, your memoirs of the about being a messenger, and Jesse Fletcher's book about the Southern Baptist Convention, mention about the financial problems Southern Baptists had during the 20s and 30s. And Jesse Fletcher even goes so far as to say that Southern Baptists had a chronic preoccupation with financial matters. So I imagine that is something that you would agree with.
Well, he speaks to his generation. Jesse, I know very, very well, as you know.
Right.
But one of the interesting things to me was that in the midst of the Depression, when we were throttled by our debts and suddenly became aware of the debts, my first convention in Washington, D.C., was the founding of what we call the 100,000 Club.
Yes.
If you can imagine paying a dollar a month beyond your tithe.
Uh-huh.
I was a member of it from first to its victory in 44.
Oh, my.
And Ms. Nayland and I belonged to it. That represented 1%, actually, of our income in that first church. And it was a glory thing. The slogans of the 40s,
mm-hmm.
Debt-free in 43.
Right, right.
Remarkable.
And so you think that also developed a stewardship consciousness among Southern Baptists that helped after the war?
No question about it.
Right, right. Do you remember anything about the Baptist Honor Day?
Did you mean by that related to this Honor Club program?
Right.
Oh, yes. In our church, where I pastored at the time, whenever they had a debt-paying day, an honor day, we participated. We took an offering.
Right.
Regardless. Mm. And it does things for you.
Right. Right. Let me move on to my next question, and it's a little bit off of financial matters, but it deals with, of course, some of the same things we've been talking about. Jesse Fletcher mentions in his book about the Southern Baptist Convention that after World War II, Southern Baptists looked at the world with new eyes, and he writes that one reason was that more of them, Southern Baptists, than ever before had seen the world firsthand through the armed services and the war, that the evangelistic and missionary spirit inherent in Southern Baptist life developed strongly during the 4 years of the war and waited for a chance to break forth. Do you agree with that? And if so, could you elaborate?
Following the war, these hundreds of thousands of young people that have been out there involved in the war, risking their lives, they made commitments in the midst of it. In the years immediately following, in the seminary, there was a flood of new students, new commitments, many of them with GI benefits.
In the seminary with GI benefits.
Help them to go.
Right.
But oh yes, there was a surge after the war, and we had a new look at the world, because in those war years, as I indicated, our people had an opportunity to see the world in a fashion they've never seen it.
Right. Right. Well, so that really put thousands of Southern Baptists overseas to places they had maybe up to that point only heard about, and they came back with a personal experience of being overseas then.
And there had been, during the period actually of the war, we'd been sending a few missionaries privately, personally supported. I remember one well who was my classmate who went to China, and our missionaries, there were missionaries, we didn't even have money enough to bring them home.
Right.
All of me, but the force dwindled down. Well, that certainly lived through the war, and we were ready for people when it was done.
I see. Well, I have a neighbor here in North Carolina who served in Italy and North Africa during World War II, and he maintains a very special spirit of sensitivity to world events, and is a deacon in his church, and is rather enthusiastic about supporting missions. So I can see how all of that would certainly build a missionary spirit then.
This is the world to which Jesus had called them, and for which he had made a redeemer's price. And you know, that came together after the war.
Dr. Nary, my next question deals with the popular conception that after World War II, or that World War II encouraged religious feelings, and as a result, church attendance grew dramatically. Did you witness that? Would you agree with that? And do you think that contributed as well to the missionary advance following World War II?
I think there was a contribution. You could overplay it that night when you talk about the years of growth. We had the million more in 54.
Right.
The evangelistic campaign. Some of the great evangelistic campaigns of Southern Baptists took place in those 15, 20 years following the war.
Mm-hmm.
And we surely would do wrong to not remember that.
Right, right. In 1921, in his report about the 75 million campaign, L.R. Scarborough reported to the convention that 10,000 young people surrendered to ministry and missions. And then later, to his biographer, H.E. Dana, he commented that he personally had a list of 15,000 who surrendered to ministry and missions. And this was some 17 years after the initial campaign. Do you know of what happened to those who surrendered to ministry and missions during the 75 million campaign?
I would not directly identify them, but I could well believe that this was true. The 75 million campaign was a great introduction to the century.
Mm.
And Dr. Scarborough, there's not enough could be said about the leadership he brought to it. I was visiting in a home in the years gone by who said that they had the Mother's Bible, a family related to us in those years. As I thumbed through it, a paper fell out. It was the name of my father and my mother and five of our children who had made a contribution to the 75 million campaign.
Oh!
And that was my name.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the youngest. And, oh yes, they fought through. And actually, it became the strength of the testing times that were ahead.
I guess it did, didn't it?
Yes.
I can see that.
Dr. Scarborough, you asked questions about these men.
Right.
Was magnificent. His spirit was just undaunted.
Mm.
When I was a student in the seminary, I never heard a low note from him.
Mm.
He taught evangelism. He wrote those books on evangelism. He was a flame of fire. He got up out of his chair preaching. Remarkable.
Oh, my. And so there's no question in your mind then that much of what he did in the 20s and 30s contributed to the post-war expansion in missions and ministry and evangelism then.
Indeed so.
Yeah.
Indeed so. I had a man, chairman of trustees named William Fleming, a great layman in the Southern Baptist line. He often said to me that Dr. Truett said to him, "Will, if we lose everything else, we must keep the seminary."
Mm-hmm. Well, we've commented on L.R. Scarborough and his legacy after the war. How about George Truett? How would you comment? Right.
In every sense, I discussed the noon preaching services in the convention in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a magnificent preacher. I heard him preach at the Baptist World Alliance in 39.
Mm-hmm.
And as a chairman of our trustees at the seminary, when I became a trustee, Dr. Twitt was just in every respect at the top of the list.
Right. I imagine you would probably say the same about J.R. Sampi and C.E. Madry and J.B. Lawrence.
I refer to the fact that Dr. Sampi was our commencement speaker when I finished the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
In 32.
Right. Right. Dr. Naylor, I want to move on to Southwestern Seminary itself.
Yes.
And the comment, or a comment that Dr. Easton made in class one day about if you want a theological education, go to Southern, or a revival meeting, go to Southwestern. You know, I'm not questioning Southern's commitment to the Great Commission or the quality of theological education at Southwestern, but that was his humorous axiom in class that day. And even Jesse Fletcher mentioned some of the differences between the two seminaries in his book. But the question I wanted to ask you is, how did, in your opinion, how did the unique evangelistic and missionary focus of Southwestern contribute to the missionary progress following the war, World War II?
The best answer to that is that through all these years, Southwestern has provided at least 50% of all the missionaries we've sent out.
Oh, my, I didn't know that.
Yes, and that is true even today.
Yeah.
And all the two seminaries, when I came here to the seminary in 1928, I had to make a choice that summer after God had dealt with me. I had to make a choice between Southern Seminary and Southwestern. I'd never seen a seminary.
Yes.
And so I sometimes say, it sounds like he said, I sometimes say, well, I almost went to Southern. They had a gymnasium.
About that.
But as a matter of fact, great seminary dating back to our Civil War days.
Right.
And a magnificent contribution to Southern Baptist life.
Right, right. So, but you do feel that Southwestern had a unique contribution then, and of course you just said that half of our missionaries have come from Southwestern. That's remarkable.
About that. They counted themselves on the frontier, and it was a flame.
Yeah.
Dr. Scarver's book, A Flame, is very much in point, and he was, of course, much of the kindling flame.
Right, right. Let's see, both you and Jesse Fletcher mentioned that in 1946, during the centennial celebration of the Southern Baptist Convention, that Southern Baptists set a goal of reaching and winning about 1 million people to Christ. The goal wasn't reached, but we did win 500,000 converts in that year. Do you have an opinion as to how that those converts impacted our missionary progress and expansion?
Well, they directly impacted out of the evangelistic thrust of the non-mission, and at the heart of it, for that matter,
right,
was the concept of world missions. God had said, every man is the object of redeeming grace, and it was a flame. So when I say 1 million more in 54,
right,
this was the campaign around which all the churches had simultaneous revivals.
Yes.
It wasn't uncommon for a city to have 15 or 20 churches covenant together to have revivals.
Oh my.
And and we never have baptized more people than we did in those middle 50s.
You're right. You're right. We did better than I think we ever have.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Nader, one final question. Are there other factors from the 20s and the 30s that you believe caused the missions advance following World War II?
It was the culmination.
Mm-hmm.
If you began at the early part of the century, when they discovered each other, the cooperative program.
Right.
The goals involved, and then the depression, the war and the world and God moving, such a sense of his moving that the missionary enterprise, our daughter is a general surgeon in India, been there 24 years.
Right, Rebecca, familiar,
and,
right.
Every year a challenge and every year a struggle.
Right.
With the government. She's still there in the hospital rooms. People think she said 103 baptized.
Oh.
Saved in the last 6 months.
Oh.
And, you know, when you talk about Baptists and our basic commitments and the culmination of the century, you must talk about the mission thrust, that it's every Christian's job.
Right.
And he's had it right.
Okay. Right. So what you're saying then is that really a culmination of events, the first 40 years of the 20th century, really are what led to such a great missionary advance after the war then?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.